Today on the 21st Show, Darren Bailey has announced another run for governor of Illinois. The downstate farmer easily won the Republican primary in 2022, but went on to lose to Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker by 13 points. Bailey's quick rise raises a question. How did a relatively obscure state lawmaker from rural Illinois end up with his party's nomination? A new book argues the mainstream media bears much of the responsibility for giving Bailey the platform from which he launched his campaign. It's called Amplifying Extremism. We'll talk about it with co-author and communications professor Nick Usher. I'm Brian Mackey. That's coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Republican Darren Bailey is running again for governor. That announcement came yesterday afternoon. Bailey was, of course, the Republican nominee last time around, losing to Governor J.B. Pritzker in 2022. His quick rise to prominence raises the question of how a relatively obscure state lawmaker with very little track record of legislative success became his party's nominee for governor. My guest today argues that we in the media played an outsized role in boosting Bailey's initial burst into the public consciousness. Nick Usher writes that Darren Bailey's case offers insight into the ways in which the ordinary work of journalism may serve to facilitate the rapid rise of extremist politicians. Here's what President Donald Trump said about Darren Bailey at a campaign event in 2022 in Mendon, Illinois.
Darren is a fearless supporter of the Second Amendment and a tireless champion of religious liberty. He will crack down on the violent crime that is devouring our Democrat-run cities and restore the state of Illinois to greatness. Darren has my complete and total endorsement.
Today we're going to explore Darren Bailey's rise in Illinois politics and see where the mainstream media, even public media, might have gone wrong in covering Bailey's past campaign for governor. You can join us today at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We're going to be talking about this with Nick Usher, an associate professor in communications at the University of San Diego. Their new book, out this year from Cambridge University Press, is called Amplifying Extremism: Small Town Politicians, Media Storms, and American Journalism. I should say, Nick used to be on the faculty at Illinois and co-authored this book with Jessica Hagman, a social science librarian and associate professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Nick Usher, welcome back to the 21st Show. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And I guess I should just start out at the beginning of this conversation and saying my priors. This was kind of a surreal experience reading this book, or at least unusual, because I know the subject pretty well. Longtime listeners might know I was a state house reporter for many years before becoming a talk show host. I know a lot of the names of the reporters cited. I respect most of them. In some cases, I consider them friends. But I'm going to try hard not to be defensive in this conversation because, Nick, I have a lot of respect for your work as well. And, you know, you had that thought-provoking book a few years ago, News for the Red, White, and Blue, we talked about. So that's sort of my baseline for this conversation. And with that said, I want to ask you if you remember how you first heard about Darren Bailey. You were still in Illinois at the time.
Yeah, I think I first heard about Darren Bailey during COVID, and he kind of, like for many people, was the first person from a blue state who was a Republican to really outwardly challenge the emergency powers of Pritzker. And I think he just kind of burst on the scene as sort of like the first visible anti-masker that captured public attention back in 2020. And I think that what was interesting is that based on my research with the Illinois Republican Party, which was a really fun and welcoming space for me, given its old sort of like pro-business Republicanism, I learned a lot. And that side of the party really did not see him as an immediate threat, or kind of just saw him as super fringe and kind of didn't see how he might gain power and attract attention given kind of the political headwinds. I heard about him. I don't remember exactly how, but I remember just, oh wow, this is the first of all of it, right? Was what crossed my head in 2020.
And I want to get into a little bit about what the Republican Party thought of him, and maybe what that may say more about the Republican Party establishment here and their understanding of their own voters than him. But we can come back to that. So Bailey was not a particularly notable politician before this, right? He'd been a state representative. He went on to be elected to the state Senate. Talk about how. You know, his actual, like, what did he actually do during COVID to sort of raise his profile?
So I want to say that he actually was a particularly, as a state rep in his early days, and state senator, particularly kind of ineffective. I think he passed one bill that he sponsored compared to an average of about 16 of his Republican colleagues based on our work. But really the kind of big moment is that Bailey sued Pritzker for overreach of his emergency powers. And he did so in Clay County Courthouse. And that was kind of the tipping point for sort of all of the attention, because here is this downstate politician challenging the authority of the governor, which at the time was quite extensive. In Illinois, I think JB extended his emergency orders up until I think March 2020. It was 20, like it was, it went on for far longer than the COVID pandemic, actually was a major threat, right? So that's kind of that moment back in 2020 when he challenged the governor.
Yeah,
Particularly April 23rd is well known.
yeah. Well, and maybe we should remember how, you know, this was very early in the pandemic. The sort of stay-at-home orders, colloquially called lockdown, came about in mid to late March. So we're still within the first month or two of trying to figure out what's happening. Yeah.
And so I think that's kind of what is hard to see in hindsight. Now that we know kind of the course that the pandemic has taken, maybe if we knew kind of in retrospect, people were really stacked. There were body bags, in major cities across the country. And so this was a real threat, but in downstate Illinois, I remember just thinking, do I know anybody who has COVID, right? Has this hit here yet? We're 3 weeks behind Chicago. When is this coming, right? And for a lot of smaller communities, if you close down the local restaurant, there is only one local restaurant, and all of a sudden you've caught up not just a gathering place, but that area's economy. And all of a sudden there aren't people who are around to be servers, right? Who aren't making money from their wait staff jobs. Like, so there's just like, I think the way that it was hitting rural Illinois at that time was that it hadn't really come on as like a serious infection that grabbed people's fear. But the restrictions seemed to be really curtailing economic activity that in an already fragile economic environment. So I do think it's important to recognize that,
Yeah, and I, you know, in a lot of ways, I think he was reflecting the views of his constituents, right? And I think you're saying that as well.
I mean, I think his constituents were not very many proportionate to kind of the strength of the population up in Chicago and the collar counties. I think it's important to remember, what part of the state he was representing relative to the state's population dynamics. But yeah.
Definitely 9 million people in the Chicago metropolitan area out of a state of 12 million. It tells you where the people are. Let me take a moment to reintroduce our conversation. If you're just tuning in, it's the 21st show. We're talking with Nick Usher, professor in communications at the University of San Diego, formerly a professor here in Illinois, at the University of Illinois. And they have written a new book, co-authored with Jessica Hagman, also from Illinois, called Amplifying Extremism: Small Town Politicians, Media Storms, and American Journalism. It basically makes the case that the mainstream media, not conservative media necessarily, is what catapulted Darren Bailey from an obscure state lawmaker to somebody with statewide and even nationwide recognition, which he then later parlayed into becoming the Republican nominee for governor back in 2022. And of course, coincidentally, we had scheduled this conversation a little while back. He happened to announce his another campaign for governor yesterday afternoon. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So your argument basically is the media made Bailey the prominent figure he became. Walk us through that.
Yeah, so let's start with just day one, the lawsuit, the announcement of the lawsuit in Clay County Courthouse on April 23rd, 2020. It's covered by the Associated Press, by the State House reporter. And it is also his Bailey's Facebook Live video gains traction on WAND and WSIL, which are stations that are actually owned by one is owned by somebody on the board participated in the insurrection, and the other is owned by one of the few Black station owners through Allen Communications in the country. So you can't really be like, oh, you know, it was like the right-wing owned local television. But what you can say is that local television was covering politics. They were covering, and they live streamed it on the website and kept it there very prominently. And this is just Bailey not being questioned. This is literally him talking in front of the courthouse saying, you know, this is my lawsuit. There's no interjection by journalists. It's literally just like a direct to consumer video facilitated through the platform of two very large local news stations, local television news stations, which, and local television news is among the most trusted news out there, right? And then the Associated Press, which reaches something like 4,000 news outlets across the country every day and has like a potential audience of like, I don't know, like 200 million people at any given point across the world, right? So it's a huge jump, right, to get this attention from national media and local television at the starting point on just day one.
Is this what you call a media storm in political science, political communications circles?
So I want to just drop some credit to the coiner of this term, media storm, Amber Boydston, who is at UC Davis. But a media storm is characterized by just like this rapid onslaught of coverage that then really just kind of dies down. Whereas most issues kind of go in like, you know, if you remember, like from evolutionary biology, like a punctuated equilibrium, they come up and down and up and down and up and down. And this one just shoots through so completely out of proportion to how it was ever covered before. And that's really the difference that you see in his initial onslaught of coverage. I think now you see that punctuated equilibrium happening.
So I think we should talk about how the media is organized in Illinois, which is a big part of the book and, you know, what happened here. Maybe you can talk about the structure of the media sort of writ large in Illinois at this time, at least.
So we know that all across the country and also in Illinois, that local media has really been softening and weakening due to sort of the rise of the internet, which has been going on for a while, right? But also the rise of platforms, the digital attention economy, declines in population in rural areas. So there's kind of been this perfect storm for what we call legacy media, so like print, radio, local television, to the point where Illinois actually had a local task force that run through the governor's office that you all have had on the show before that I've been part of, right? So this has been seen as a statewide crisis. All in all, Illinois hasn't lost as many newspapers as you might think. There's still about 400 newspapers and 100 broadcast stations that are members of the State Press Association. So it's like okay-ish, but on the decline. And a lot of those news outlets get their State House coverage from a foundation-supported Capital News Illinois, which is a great service that gives State House coverage for free to any member of the State Press Corps. But this has the unanticipated effect of also meaning that people who are who are downstate representatives who would otherwise maybe not get notice up in one of the collar counties, because that same content is being broadcast regardless of geography to anybody who who is getting a newspaper that is using Capital News Illinois content. There's like this accidental amplification effect that actually comes from an effort to rebuild local news in Illinois. So that's one aspect. Stop me if you want to jump in and
No, it's the irony, right? The irony.
right. So you've got this terrible irony. Then you've got love you all so much, but public media, right? And you all are actually more networked, I think, than people realize, because you're all, this station and the Springfield station and then Northern Illinois Radio, right? You're not only are you using NPR content, but you're also recirculating each other's content, because that makes sense, right? Nobody has the staff to cover everything. And
We're one of the
so
biggest networks in the country by far. 400 stations. Yeah, definitely.
yeah, and so you're all, you're sharing content across each other's, and that is a good thing, right? That's an economies of scale thing. But when that content is shared that maybe casts more attention than is proportionately, I don't know, a disproportionate amount of attention relative to sort of the story itself or the incident itself, right? That again has this amplification effect. There's also a local newspaper chain, Shaw Media, which I'd like to point out is privately owned and has lots of newspapers across the Midwest. Many of their stories run from a syndicated statehouse bureau. They pay to still have statehouse reporters, right? And it makes sense that their statehouse reporters are covering all or sharing their content across Shaw Media outlets, right? So there's like these syndication effects. And then
Sure.
of course you have the Associated Press, right?
Right. So
And so
I'm
there's
gonna interrupt you there. I'm sorry to do so, but we're on a
no worries.
fixed clock, so we need to take a break. Yeah, we'll continue this conversation when we come back. If you want to join Nick Usher and me to talk about Darren Bailey's rise and whether the mainstream media is responsible for that, as their new book argues, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. More to come. This is the 21st Show. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Nick Usher, Associate Professor of Communications at the University of San Diego, previously a professor here at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and co-author of Amplifying Extremism, Small Town Politicians, Media Storms, and American Journalism. It's a book that looks at basically the idea that the mainstream media was largely responsible for elevating then State Representative Darren Bailey from a relatively obscure and, as we've heard, sort of ineffectual as measured by pieces of legislation actually passed, state lawmaker to somebody with a statewide platform, even a national platform, big enough to catapult him to be his party's nominee for governor just less than 2 years later. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number. That's 800-222-9455. We asked some of our listeners in our texting group about this, what they think about just sort of this topic and trust in the mainstream media in general. Ryan in Champaign says this is not a new issue. The press work for the ruling class. They exist to move public opinion the direction the ruling class wants. We also heard from a texter in Mattoon who said, I don't think the mainstream media made Bailey. The only thing that's different is Bailey's a Southern Illinois Republican running for a statewide position. That's what's different. Again, if you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. All right, I want to dig into this idea that it was really the media that elevated Bailey, because if his own campaign manager, Jose Durbin, who was 27 years old at the time, he credits a lot of their success to social media and talked about that in a Politico article, for example. How do you, in your actual analysis, try and separate out those effects?
Okay, so I just want to pull back and just say how we did this work, because I think that can highlight the temporal period that we're looking at. So we're really looking at a 10-day period from April 23rd to May 3rd, basically, of coverage about Bailey, right? At this point, he has a relatively small social media platform. The social media buzz that he has, right, is really all being attracted at this point. So I want to give you a couple of numbers just to kind of drive this home. So what we did is we looked across television, radio, digital first. We looked on Twitter to make sure we didn't miss anything where we did not see a ton of engagement. So basically, we looked at every possible form of media content that mentioned his name and looked at that content, right? And in total, without any kind of replication of stories, there were a total of 596 stories over this 10-day period that focused on him. And in terms of this syndicated coverage that we've been talking about, 62% of total local news coverage, or 338 of the 543 local stories, were actually syndicated from elsewhere. So they weren't originally byline stories by the outlet itself. So I just want to, we're looking at this 10-day period in which Chicago's PBS station gives him a 19-minute extended interview, right? So I think that you have to grant that kickstart to all of the social media that followed to this moment where he's anointed. And he's anointed finally 5 days later after the lawsuit on the Laura Ingraham show on Fox, which had at the time something like 3.6 million people. It had some of its largest audiences to date during the COVID pandemic. So that's the period that we're looking at. And the way that you build a social media following is what we've learned is often an engagement between the traditional media, which further amplifies the social media content. When you hear about something going viral, you may have seen it in your feed, or you may have encountered it in a news article. You read about the viral phenomenon, which further propels it, right? So anything social media, I think, comes much later, or comes as a result of this starting point. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I think that's fair. What about how do the norms of journalism play into this? And you say that extremist candidates on different from different political backgrounds, not just right wing, could be left wing as well, have sort of, I don't know if you'd call it a toolbox, but there are ways that they can sort of exploit the norms of journalism, political journalism especially, to gain attention for themselves. How did that play out here?
So I want to be very, very careful about the use of this word extremism. I think at this point, Bailey having won the gubernatorial candidacy once is not cannot really be considered an extremist for where the Republican Party of Illinois is today, by the kinds of candidates that they're putting forward as representatives of their party, right? But when
He's
he
pretty
first,
mainstream now
yeah.
for
So
yeah, definitely.
I think that we need to be really clear that at the moment in time in which I was looking at this, and at the beginning, in 2020, Darren Bailey was very much out of step of the mainline Republican Party. And so that is why I called him an extremist, right?
Well, maybe let's actually I'll set aside my previous question then to dig into that since you're taking it here. I wondered about that because I mean, President Trump was already pulling the party very much in his direction at that time. I mean, if you look back in Illinois Republican history, Jeanne Ives almost defeated Governor Bruce Rauner. She was quite conservative, like from the right, I should say, in 2018 in the gubernatorial primary. I mean, the party, this person wasn't elected, but the party chose to bring in Alan Keyes in 2004 to run against Barack Obama. Name may not mean much to people today, but he was quite right wing back then. So why do you see Bailey as kind of a departure for Republicans?
I mean, I think that the conventional knowledge among sort of the establishment Republicans is that, and this is like, 2020, 2022, that in order to capture statewide office, you've got to peel off, right? Because statewide office is a majority vote. It's not like a representative of a district vote, right? So in order to capture a state mandate, you need to be able to peel off kind of these purple or light or kind of like, is it light blue? That's like light blue for like less Democrat, but not like these not solid stalwart lifetime Democrats from the color counties and from Cook County itself. And the only way you can attract those folks is by having a more moderate, pro-business Republican that appeals to like taxes and, a more efficient government. Something I think most people in Illinois would agree that the Democratic machine could, I mean, I don't want to speak for everyone, but right, the Democratic machine is well known and famously corrupt, right? Let's not forget about Madigan. And so I think that the conventional knowledge has been that you need to have kind of a moderate pro-business Republican to capture those sort of more moderates up
I'll
in the
definitely grant that is the elite sort of consensus, I think, among the traditional Republicans here. I'm not sure that the voters have been in that place for a
No,
while,
and
and
I
maybe
think
that's the issue.
that's the difference, right? The big difference is that there's been this misreading of where Republicans in where ordinary kind of organizing Republicans in the state of Illinois, especially downstate, are politically. And I think that conventionally, Illinois hasn't been some super Bible thumping state, but I think that, state religious groups and that there's been a strengthening around faith and that with that strengthening around faith particularly in Christian communities that has also pulled folks more right and so there's been these the shifts that have happened across the Republican Party at the national level have also happened in Illinois and I think Darren Bailey is kind of like the first wave to really make that message hit home. And initially, right, JB thought that Bailey would be the easiest person to run against because he was too extreme for Illinois. But
As the campaign ads had it,
yeah,
yes.
right. And I just don't think that at this point he that can really be said about Bailey anymore. I think he is representative of the current nature of the Republican Party and its base in the state of Illinois. And no, the mainstream media did not create those social changes and identity-based changes and economic changes that have shifted the nature of what the Republican Party is all about. But in terms of lifting arguments, simply, and this is kind of to your question around news norms, when you talk in the language of kind of constitutionalism, like I'm fighting for freedom, right? I'm not anti-mask. I am fighting for freedom, right? That gives a credibility to actions that were fundamentally at that point against the rule of law. So, I mean, I think my like he said, I'm this is a quote from the Pontiac. It's a Pontiac Daily Leader. I'm not anti-mask. I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm pro-freedom. We decide, right? That's a direct Bailey quote. And that is a convincing rhetorical posture, right? He's not saying, I don't believe the democratically elected governor of the state of Illinois does not have the right to enact emergency policy during a pandemic that is like causing body bags to, pile up in major cities, right? That's not what you hear. You hear this rhetoric of freedom and who doesn't want freedom, right? Like that is the bedrock, right? And so in kind of parodying word for word, which is what reporting is, right? In stenographic reporting, there's often not enough space to provide adequate context and critique. And the kind of he said, she said, they said journalism doesn't really like it can give too much weight to arguments that are not valid, just in trying to give balance, something called false balance. So I think that pursuit of objectivity, that reluctance to kind of make value judgments, and the desire to kind of represent everybody equally, even if their views are not actually equally held, really has the potential to introduce extremist viewpoints and legitimize them, right? So that's one thing. The other thing is like, this was a juicy story, right? Like, this was like, a classic we talked in journalism school I no longer work at one but at the University of Illinois Department of Journalism this is the classic man bites dog right like a blue big blue governor in a wildly blue state is challenged by a downstate Republican for the first time for these COVID policies and the actual just judicial decision which I think really catapulted some national attention The actual decision was a restraining order against JB just for Darren Bailey. So he was the only person in the state who no longer had to follow the COVID emergency policies that, right? And so there was this like very weird quirk of the ruling. It had the elements of the juicy narrative of conflict and downstate versus upstate and Republican versus Democrat that played into every sort of like attention grabby trope of what journalism is all about, right? And that's okay, but it's important to just understand that this is something that happens. And we know, that extremes tend to get attention because those are the good stories, right? Like, can you believe this, right? But that can you, like, I take the flat earth as the best example, right? Flat earthers were like this wacky fringe group for a while. And then The Guardian started covering flat earth conventions. And then the New York Times got on it, and then like propelling the word of flat and legitimizing the flat earthers by including them in their coverage, even if that coverage was just to be like, there are people who are flat earthers out there, right? And so
Yeah,
that
and now we're
phenomenon.
losing vaccines. I got you. I follow. It's all connected. Let's I want to I, before we need to take another break, let's see if we can get a couple of phone calls in at 800-222-9455. Diane has been waiting on the line from Rockford. Diane, thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thank you. The GOP has basically reduced politics to entertainment and superficial terms. And Darren Bailey is just an example of the league of GOP candidates who have seized on national or local issues to basically build themselves up deliberately into political characters and candidates. Going for fame and as opposed to substance. But the problem is that they've taken it to such an extent that all they've done is deliberately introduce disinformation into the political process to mislead voters. And so one no longer knows what the facts are. When Darren teamed up with Attorney Thomas DeVore to file his lawsuits against the against Pritzker's emergency actions, most of the legal community in Illinois ignored it because they kind of dismissed it, knowing that the legal challenges had no legal basis for it, and they were ultimately consolidated and then dismissed. But these politicians have engaged in this action repeatedly to the fact that they no longer face any consequences for their actions, and on the other hand, they've completely derailed American politics.
Thank you so much for the call. Diane Paul is calling from Urbana online too. Paul, thank you for calling in.
I'm here to the other side of the screen, and this side of the
Paul,
phone.
all right, I think we might have lost Paul
Okay,
there. So,
then I'll have a big
oh,
shot that'll get the
Paul, are
picture.
you with us?
I'll around then in the
All right,
audience.
yeah, let's say thank you to Paul. Nick, we got about a minute and a half before we need to take a break if you want to respond to anything Diane said there.
I mean, I think that we also can't discount the fact that many people are tuning out from news and information. And so there's kind of this real tension between hoping that people will pay attention to substance and, keeping their attention at a time when there's millions of things competing for it, especially digitally. I think the stories that really aren't getting told enough are the consequences of all of this rhetoric on ordinary day-to-day lives. For me, the untold story that really could have made bigger news than it did was the fact that in the early days, somebody, just an ordinary person with COVID, felt like they could ignore the masking bans and went about their day in Richland County to go to Walmart, and I believe it was like Walmart and CVS and get gas, right? So this person with like an active COVID case is like, ah, right? And so the way that this empowered ordinary individuals to do things that might have real consequences, like exposing an entire Walmart to COVID, right? The harms to ordinary people as a result of the rhetoric really needs to be the story that I think draws our attention because that is a story about people and not about politicians.
Yeah.
And it's a hard one to get away from because we cover, journalists cover knowns. right? Journalists cover the governor.
All right, we're gonna have to take another break. Sorry to interrupt you again. We're on a fixed clock. We will come back and have more with Nick Usher when we return. 800-222-9455. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Nick Usher, professor, associate professor of communications at the University of San Diego, previously on the faculty at the University of Illinois, author most recently of Amplifying Extremism, Small Town Politicians, Media Storms, and American Journalism. Co-authored with Jessica Hagman from the University of Illinois. It's about Darren Bailey's rise to prominence during a very short period of time. This is before he became the Republican nominee for governor, but it's how he went from being a essentially unknown state lawmaker to somebody with a statewide, even national profile. And Usher argues it's largely because of mainstream media coverage that Bailey received. Usher's work focuses on the crosshairs of media, technology, politics. They're also the author of News for the Rich, White, and Blue, How Place and Power Distort American Journalism, which we talked about a few years ago on this program. So a couple of it. So we have about 14 minutes left. I want to talk about some actionable ideas that you may have for what, you know, journalism can do when confronted with these sorts of dilemmas. But before that, I do want to talk about the idea. There has been some pushback that journalism was maybe had too much of a thumb on the scale during the early days of COVID. I mean, look, I was pretty frightened of this disease when we didn't know much about it. But I mean, there have been multiple books written now, a prominent one by well-respected political scientists, Francis Lee and Stephen Macedo, I think is how you say that name, In COVID's Wake, How Our Politics Failed Us, saying that we should have had more of an open conversation on things like masking and even vaccines and things like that in the early days of COVID, and that too many media outlets, and I think we probably did this at the 21st Show, were not willing to, you know, engage with the people who thought, this is just a bunch of baloney. It's nothing to worry about, just like the flu. I wonder, Nick Usher, how you think about that.
I mean, I think that they're separate critiques, right? The critique around the way COVID was handled in the media versus the way that politicians with kind of eye-grabbing rhetoric that is disproportionate and out of touch with what their constituency might actually believe or say. Those are two very, I think, to me, different questions/critiques. But I would say I do largely agree with the critique that folks doing the journalism around those early days of COVID. There's a real tendency during times of crisis to basically parrot back the official line. You see that during disaster response, and you see that during wartime.
Rally around the flag, you know, right?
Rally around the flag, right? And COVID, and especially initially, was like this moment of like, we're wartime pandemic, right? But you got to remember the vast majority of journalism is produced in large cities. And those large cities were the ones that were really seeing like the most scary elements of COVID happening right in front of them. I mean, New York City, people were banging pots and pans out their window to thank first responders for, you know, like, I mean, it's hard to even remember that there were like chips of body bags, right? Like, so people who were journalists living in these large cities watching the pandemic spread rapidly had a really different perspective than, you know, I remember going to the playground with my son and like feeling like a bad person because it was like week two of COVID's restrictions, but there was nobody on the playground and nobody in sight because they're we're like no people, right? Like the proportion of people per land in downstate Illinois, right? And it just seemed ridiculous that my child couldn't go to the playground, which was outside, when there was nobody there. Like, and I think that kind of disconnect, if I'm feeling it, right, is only 10x amplified for those who have reasons to distrust the news media or have kind of been culturally encouraged to do so.
Let's give Paul another try at 800-222-9455. Paul, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm in a busy environment, but I wanted to know if you've. I'm pretty persuaded by the thesis because it fits in with the overall critique of media of not giving people enough time who have a divergent opinion to express it. Principles of concision and sound bites. But is there anybody that's looking at this more like broadly across the country, and you know, extrapolating from that, if you will? And I'll listen on the radio. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is a enduring question of people like me who study the news media and people who study the intersection of politics and journalism and political communication. We're constantly trying to assess the effect of how the news media shifts public opinion. And I think that if we'd unpacked it and had an answer, I'd be able to tell you what it was. But what we are seeing is that these enduring norms of journalism that have long propelled kind of like independent objective journalism in this country may not have always been the best way to cover some of these controversial issues, because there's a tendency to focus disproportionately on arguments that have no merit. Right, or minimal merit. And I think climate change is one of the best studied examples where, you know, people who are anti-climate scientists are like 3% of all scientists. But if you look at stories, there's like very much, we need to quote the climate scientists who don't believe in global climate change, right? And we have seen changes though, right? Up until maybe the last major, okay, so for mass shootings, right? Because I don't think Charlie Kirk was not a mass shooting, right? It was an assassination. That's a different category. But mass shooting coverage used to focus on like, here's the shooter, and this is like everything we need to know about the shooter, and this is their manifesto, right? And would elevate this mass shooter into like almost like a dark hero, right? For would-be copycats. And that coverage has really changed to focus on who's been hurt and how the kids have, you know, how communities have been shaking, who the victims are. And so we have seen shifts in news coverage thanks to people who have really pointed out the ways in which standard operating procedure of the American news media can sometimes just have really unintended consequences.
I hear you on that. I think that's a great point. I think, suicide is another area where journalism has had to learn some lessons about, you know, the contagion effects that happen when there's too much attention on people who engage in that. I guess the issue, and I don't mean to come back to COVID again and early COVID, but this is where I get a little confused, because to me, I think some of us in journalism thought maybe by trusting the scientists, trusting the public health authorities, not giving as much voice to the skeptics, we were doing the version of not quoting the flat earthers, not quoting the climate deniers, right? And I think that's where I personally have some trouble. So I wonder, I guess maybe that's a good parlay into the idea. What actionable, you know, do you have any advice for journalism? You know, what would you have wanted to see differently in this case or in the future?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, about like, that's a fair response that you've given, but I think that the problem is that, you know, there's a something between giving voice and kind of like what's it, like caricaturing arguments and giving people a chance to explain where they're coming from, right? So I think a lot about my hairdresser in Champaign, who is coming from St. Charles, and you know, her kid was in like this tiny kindergarten class where she was related to pretty much everybody in the town, or they, you know, grown up with everybody in the town. She was like, look, I'd rather my kid go to kindergarten and be entertained in the kindergarten. And if one of these people who I have known my whole life happens to get my kid sick, like, that is scary, but that's a risk I'm willing to take because I trust and know these people. And I live in the small town where there's like, and that's like, you know, like a working mom just trying to go to her job and like care for her, you know, make sure her kid is like taken care of. Like, that's the story we didn't hear, right? It became like these people don't believe in science, right? We rarely heard the story about like, well, if we shut down, I think what's that, Ogden has that like barbecue place. Like if you shut down the barbecue place, like all of a sudden nobody has a salary, right? Like the major employer in the town goes away, right? Those were the stories that like didn't get told. Instead, it became a story of like these people are so dumb, they don't believe in science. And that's where I think things went wrong, right? When you sort of critique people, like these people should have known better, right? The smug that creeps into to journalism and academia. And I think that it's easy to go with the smug and forget that people have other reasons. And I think that those were sort of the stories that were going missing.
I think that's a great point. So what about the Darren Bailey case in particular, right? You said that the media often doesn't provide or maybe have the time and space or take the time and space to provide context. Is it something it should have ignored altogether? That certainly doesn't feel right. I can hear myself arguing with an editor about whether to just ignore this lawsuit that Darren Bailey filed in 2020. Go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, I think that this became like a classic example of conflict, like Bailey versus Pritzker, downstate versus upstate. And nobody really pushed back on kind of what Bailey was doing, or his language of rights and freedom. Like why was this language of rights and freedom accurate and worthy of note at the most extreme point in the COVID crisis, right? Like to me that and you gotta remember, right, this is like month one, no vaccine, ventilators still being clogged up by people, like we don't know how to treat this thing. It's far deadlier and causes far worse consequences than it does today when you can get a vaccine, right?
And I had many personal months of being very frightened to go out in public. I had it for
Right.
myself,
And
yes.
so like just quoting him with like, oh, you know, it's about my freedom, and not going pushing that, like, or pointing out that that's not freedom, like your freedom maybe is infringing on my freedom, right? Like you're putting me in danger, but right, like that was the pushback against that language of rights-bearing constitutionalism, I think was something that really didn't happen in this case. I also think, and I think the biggest indictment of this is that the Associated Press stories were basically just re-headlined and run in right-wing media and right-lean media without any changes, right? Like literally a article from the AP was considered so functionally on point that it just needed a new headline in outlets that were trying to make a kind of like the case for the sort of Republican perspective. And so that to me really is just kind of like something went wrong in the process. Like, and at this very early stage, there wasn't like nothing I saw was real misinformation, right? There wasn't like like we looked across all of like we looked at right wing media, we looked everywhere, right? But there wasn't the lies about COVID weren't really creeping in here yet. So we can't blame that in this case, in this brief period of his rise. And I just want to, you know, be clear that that was what our book focused on. We did not focus on the after, right?
Fair. Yeah, this is again before he was running for governor, before any of that stuff that came later. And maybe coming again, we'll see. As I said at the top of the show, Darren Bailey has announced another campaign for governor just yesterday afternoon. The book is called Amplifying Extremism: Small Town Politicians, Media Storms, and American Journalism, co-authored by our guest today, Nick Usher and Jessica Hagman of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Nick is at the University of San Diego. It's out now from Cambridge University Press. Nick, it was an enjoyable conversation today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me and highlighting this. I appreciate it.
Coming up Monday on the 21st show, we're going to be talking with ocean explorer Annie Crawley, who's a photographer, a writer, has the highest credential from the Professional Association of Diving Instructors, and she is an alum of the University of Illinois, born and raised in Chicago. She now makes her life in the sea. We'll talk with her about her life and work. She has a new film out called The Island of the Shark, Guardians of Malpelo. And we'll talk about how a girl from Chicago became a prominent ocean explorer and filmmaker. That's coming up Monday on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. I should say you can find a podcast of our show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and you can find links to all that at our website, 21stshow.org. Again, thank you for listening. We'll talk with you again on Monday.